Hello and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Schwartz. Today's episode is on individualized choices in antiretroviral therapy. It's taken from a recent live symposium and it features three experts in HIV, Professor Chloe Orkin, Professor Jean-Michel Molina, and Professor Christina Massini. To follow along with the slides from the symposium, visit the links in the show notes. Now let's get started and listen in as the program begins.
Hello, everybody. And a very, very warm welcome to all of you that are here and all of you that are online to today's CCO symposium. My name is Professor Chloe Orkin, and I'll be moderating. I'm Professor of HIV Medicine at Queen Mary University in Barts Health. And our symposium today is entitled Individualized Choices in Antiretroviral Therapy, the Present and the Future. As I've said, this program is brought to you by CCO and is kindly supported by an educational grant from Gilead Sciences. Joining me today live, which I'm absolutely delighted to say, is my dear colleague and friend, Professor Jean-Michel Molina. And joining us online is our dear colleague and friend, Professor Christina Massini. And unfortunately, she's not able to join us in person today. Professor Molina is the head of Department of Infectious Diseases at Saint-Louis Hospital Assistance Publique Hôpital de Paris and Professor of Infectious Diseases at the University of Paris. And please forgive me murdering your language. Professor Massini is the head of Department of Infectious Diseases and Tropical Medicine and full professor of infectious diseases at the Infectious Diseases Clinic, University of Modena and Reggio Emilia. And our disclosures will be forthcoming on the next, before our talks. Our agenda is we're going to be reviewing the current patient-centered treatment, and then we have a pre-recorded case-based discussion with Jean-Michel, Christina, and myself, in which she's going to present some cases and we're going to discuss them. And after that, we'll hear from Jean-Michel on the future of antiretroviral therapy, closing the remaining gaps. And then you'll have a chance, those of you who are here, to come to the microphone. So it's my great pleasure to provide an overview of current patient-centered antiretroviral therapy. So we are in an incredibly fortunate position where we have the opportunity to individualize therapy. And we have a very large number of fixed-dose combinations. And you can see that this gives us the opportunity to individualize, to avoid many different comorbidities and problems. And you can see that amongst this group are now fixed-dose combination, which consist of just two drugs. We have dolutegravir 3TC, dolutegravir rilpivirine, and we have for the first time our first injectable treatment consisting of cabotegravir rilpivirine at the bottom. So I'm going to start by talking about first-line therapy. And the important thing to say about first-line therapy is that at the moment, first-line therapy is all about tablets. We don't have injectable options in first-line treatment yet. We have trials, but we don't have actually licensed agents. So if we look at the guidelines in terms of recommended first-line treatments in 2020 and 2021, you can see that there are some very clear commonalities, and that is that integrase inhibitor-based therapy is very important and is universally recommended. You will see for EACTS, and I would encourage you to read this first column carefully because this is the hot off the press new EACTS guidelines. So remember, you saw it here first. You'll see that for EACTS, there's a much wider selection of drugs. So you can see in IAS USA and DHHS, it's simply dolutegravir or bictegravir, either with a nucleoside agent. But what you see here is that there's also raltegravir included, and there's also doravirine included in the recommended options. And I think this is important because the EACTS covers a large number of European countries, and access and availability is different in these different countries. And it's important to include options which are available for everybody who needs these guidelines. So when selecting initial therapy, there are a number of factors to consider. There's the initial characteristics which we consider in all people with HIV, such as viral load and CD4 count, genotype, HLA 5701 status. Importantly, preferences and anticipated adherence and antiretroviral timing post-diagnosis, whether it's a new diagnosis. We also consider regimen-specific considerations, which is what I was talking about, individualized to suit the specific person in front of you. But we also individualize based on specific conditions or factors. So comorbid conditions, pregnancy or wish to become pregnant, co-infections. And we discuss treatment options to determine needs and the extent to which people want to be involved in decision-making. So at this meeting, we are going to be seeing some exciting data out to 144 weeks for Doravirine and Islatravir, and we're also going to be seeing four-year data for Bictegravir in abstract PE119. So I'm going to talk about 144-week data from the Gemini study. This is a study looking at dolutegravir 3TC through to week 144. And what you can see is that non-inferiority was maintained versus TDF, FTC, and dolutegravir. Interestingly, in this study, it's important to note that there was one failure on dolutegravir 3TC who developed resistance. And this was really a patient who was non-adherent and developed resistance late at week 132. So does dolutegravir 3TC match three-drug therapy in first-line treatment? So in terms of durability, yes, it's been shown to be non-inferior through week 144. In terms of more sensitive virological markers, there have been extensive studies looking at target not detected and blip frequency and rate to suppression, which have been similar. And I note here that this is a comparison between DTD3TC versus TDF-FTC and dolutegravir. When we look at barrier to resistance, there was an excellent barrier to resistance. And as I've said, there's one case out beyond week 96. And in terms of safety and tolerability, there were better outcomes in terms of renal and bone versus TDF-FTC, which is unsurprising. An excellent efficacy in viral load greater than 100,000 copies. There was a difference when looking at the intent to treat analysis for people with CD4 counts entering the study less than 200. But this difference disappeared when you excluded people who didn't fail virologically, who failed for other reasons. So if we look at the efficacy of first-line therapy in terms of CD4 counts less than 200, it's important to note that across the board, you do see differences. It's important to note that the populations who are included with CD4 counts less than 200 are very low, and we tend to get very, very small numbers of participants who are sick. And this is because we now start therapy a lot earlier, which is a good thing. But it does mean we have very little data to support our treatment in people who have low CD4 counts and high viral loads, who really are the hardest to treat people, regardless of the drugs that you use. And it's not universal that there are differences for populations with low CD4 counts, but it certainly occurred in several studies. So let's move to the question of when to start treatment. There's a general consensus across EACS, DHHS, and IAS USA, and this is once again the newest EACS guidelines that we're talking about here. In terms of rapid treatment, there's an overarching position of starting as soon as possible, including potential for same-day start, but it does depend on medical circumstances and whether there are indications to start more quickly. But it is important to ensure that you take the person in front of you into account and their wishes. With opportunistic infections, and we're going to cover this in more detail in the cases, in some situations it may be advisable to wait and not to start immediately where there are infections which may result in severe iris, you know, things like cryptococcal meningitis, things like TB meningitis, you might really want to consider waiting. So I'm going to show you some data here, which is the stat data. But excitingly, there are some data for the first time looking at Bictegravir at this meeting in immediate treatment. So please look out for that abstract. But this is data which I was able to show and include because it's been published. This is the STAT study looking at week 48 virological outcomes with dolutegravir 3TC in newly diagnosed patients. So the study design for this study was actually including people who started treatment pretty quickly within 14 days. So you have to, immediate start is a movable feast. You know, some of us may think it's on the day when it's in your clinic, you take the person downstairs and you give them treatment, but that's not always the case. For the study, there was a window. And I think it's important to note here, so we're talking about a two-drug therapy, and you can see that in the observed group who remained on any treatment, there were excellent outcomes, but there were cases in which people needed to be switched away from DTG3TC, and these were particularly in people who may have had hepatitis B or may not have been eligible based on the baseline characteristics. There were two people that failed with confirmed virological withdrawal without resistance. both remained on the study and it was well tolerated. And in terms of the categories, in terms of the baseline categories, with the high viral loads, people tended to do well. This is interesting because Gemini studies excluded people with viral loads greater than 500,000 copies, so we don't really have data in that category very much. But in this study, a large proportion of participants had high viral loads and the outcomes were good. I would caution and say that I have to say in my personal practice, this wouldn't be my go-to solution to give someone dolutegravir 3TC on immediate therapy. I think, you know, I don't think there's an enormous rush to do this. So what to start in pregnancy? I'd encourage the audience who didn't get that question right to pay attention to this slide. So here are the USDHHS guidelines. And what they recommend is Bacavir 3TC or TDF-FTC or TDF-3TC. You'll see that TAF-FTC has now come into the guidelines, and this is based on the IMPACT 2010 data, which showed fewer adverse outcomes for people that received TAF-FTC. You can see that Raltegravir twice daily or dolutegravir is an option, and you can see that dolutegravir is an option, including if you're wishing to conceive, because the signal from the TSAPAMO data has gone away, and there's now no statistically significant difference between the use of dolutegravir or efavirenz or, in fact, people without HIV in terms of neurotubular defect. Protease inhibitors, the guidelines are twice a day, darunavir, ritonavir, although many people would use it once a day, or atazanavir, ritonavir. There's insufficient data currently for bictegravir, elvitegravir, cobicistat. Cobicistat is a problem across the board due to PK data and volume of distribution changes. There's insufficient data for doravirin, and two drug regimens are absolutely not recommended. I'm going to move to switching treatment in virologically suppressed patients. So in terms of the criteria, almost all of the criteria remain exactly the same, but what becomes increasingly important when switching people is the treatment history. And this is because of the issue around archive mutations. And it's all very well switching a patient who's been your patient from the beginning and you know their history. It's another thing if somebody comes from another clinic, you don't know what's happened, or another country, you don't know what's happened, you don't know what is in the background. Because this is particularly important when you're considering things like whether the person may have the M184V archived, because this would really change your thinking around whether you would use three drugs or two drugs. So this is very important. And it would also change your therapy, your thinking around the use of NNRTIs specifically. There's very low baseline rates of integrase inhibitors, so this is less relevant for that reason. So the EACTS recommended switch guidelines for virologically suppressed people. The objectives in switching therapy are to eliminate or improve adverse events, to facilitate management of comorbidities, to improve quality of life. But the primary concern is not to jeopardize virological suppression. And that's why understanding the treatment history, as well as reviewing the genotypes in the past, is critically important. This is a screenshot of the most recent EX guidelines. You would need to be very young to be able to read this. I can't read it. But for those eagle-eyed amongst you, you may be able to see that actually we've included the fact that you can use cabotegravir or piperine. So oral antiretrovirals for switch. You can see that switching from suppressive treatment to a single tablet regimen, there's non-inferiority across a vast range of studies. And you can see three studies, including bictegravir, FTC, and TAF, top three. There's also darunavir, FTC, and TAF. And you can see a whole host of other regimens, including the SWORD regimen, dolutegravir, rilpivirine, and dolutegravir 3TC. So you may be wondering about switching therapy and are there concerns about switching therapy? There is good data to support long-term durability for dolutegravir, rilpivirine, and dolutegravir 3TC out to at least 3 years. Good sensitivity viral markers, target not detected data there, and for blips. In terms of the barrier to resistance, there is an issue to be aware of here. So for dolutegravir 3TC in the TANGO study, there's been no resistance. But for the dolutegravir rilpivirine regimen, we are dealing with an NNRTI here, and there have been cases of resistance. And when people fail, they can fail with two-class resistance. So it's important to bear that in mind and also to bear in mind the food restrictions associated with rilpivirine and the issues around proton pump inhibitors. So that takes me to injectables. So the DHHS recommendations, so these are from February, talk about the use of this as an optimization strategy for people receiving antiretrovirals with documented suppression. So this is not for people who are not suppressed. You have to be suppressed with no baseline resistance to either medications, no virological failures, no hepatitis B, not pregnant or planning to become pregnant, and not receiving medications with significant drug interactions. So you have to think about who the right person for this combination is. They do comment on specific features of importance, and they comment that long-acting treatment may reduce pill fatigue, may alleviate disclosure concerns or stigma associated with taking daily oral therapy, and may assist with quality of life. So this is how the DHHS has considered the use of cabotegravir or piperine as a switch. So if we look at the three studies looking at long-acting cabotegravir or piperine at week 48, there are three trials. There's the FLARE study, which is for treatment-naive individuals, a study very close to my heart, who received daily oral therapy for 20 weeks and were then switched. The ATLAS study, who took people who had been virologically suppressed for at least 6 months, who were receiving daily oral therapy. And these were people were randomized to receive injectable treatment once a month or to continue their oral therapy. And then there was the ATLAS 2M study, which took participants from the ATLAS study and also people who were sort of not in the ATLAS study, fresh participants, and randomized people to receive monthly or every 2 monthly cabotegravir or piperine. For all of these studies, non-inferiority was established for the long-acting therapy compared with daily oral therapy, and every 2 monthly dosing was non-inferior to monthly dosing. In terms of durability, we now have data for the FLARE study just published in the Lancet HIV. I'm happy to say last week for the FLARE study out to week 144, and the ATLAS 2M study showed it can be given every 2 months. It was safe and well tolerated. And in terms of injection site reactions, these tend to be mostly grade 1 and 2, resolved within 3 to 7 days, and very few discontinued due to injection site reactions across the whole program. The participants overwhelmingly preferred injectable treatment to oral treatment, which is not a surprise because they've gone into a long-acting treatment study. But as I always say, we're not going to put guns to people's heads to have injectable therapy. So it only needs to be satisfying to those who want to take it. And I think it's a good lesson going forward for other long-acting programs. So is the oral lead-in always needed? So in the most recent publication on the FLARE study last week, what we showed is that the oral lead-in was not required, and the FDA allowed participants to choose and physicians to choose whether people went into the oral lead, chose to have an oral lead-in or no oral lead-in at 96 weeks. These were the participants who were on oral therapy for the first 96 weeks of the FLARE study. And there were no differences in efficacy, regardless of whether people received the oral lead-in, and no concerning hypersensitivities of any kind. It's important to note that, like with dolutegravir or piperine, they are failures, and between 1 and 1.5% have failed virologically across the program. Mostly when people do fail, they fail with resistance, often to two classes, and almost invariably they are able to be resuppressed. So that's good news. But it is important to be aware that this regimen, you know, resistance can occur in less than 2% of people. So living with COVID, the new world, I guess, it's very different. All of you are sitting here in masks. We have to think about who we bring in for face-to-face treatment. And these are difficult considerations. And we need to consider, in terms of providing therapy, how we monitor therapy, because we want to give people a therapy that we don't need to be bringing them in every 5 minutes because we're anxious about them, that we feel is secure and is safe, that we're not going to develop side effects. When we're switching, we want to switch to a regimen that we don't need to be constantly following people up and bringing them in for safety bloods. So if there was ever a time to have a regimen where we really focus on safety and on ease of monitoring, I'd say this is the time. But I do think it's important that we do switch treatment and we don't leave people on the wrong therapy because we're too frightened to make virtual switches, and we have to trust our patients and have these conversations. So our treatment goals, COVID or no COVID, remain to achieve rapid and durable suppression, to manage comorbidities and prescribing, reducing polypharmacy and avoiding drug interactions. We need to support mental health. During COVID, I make very sure that every single consultation that I do, I ask people, where are they living? Are they alone? Who have they been locked down with? Are they working from home? Where are they in their heads in terms of COVID? How isolated are they? Are they seeing friends? Are they seeing people outside? I give them advice, but I also try to make sure that people are understanding the advice and are mentally okay. And it's never been more important. I think chems and alcohol, many of us have, you know, turned to food, and others of us have turned to alcohol. Some have turned to both. So it's important to ask people, if they're not coming in, what their weight is and how they're doing in terms of alcohol. Surprisingly, I'm sure Jean-Michel will, non-surprisingly, will know this, people are still having sex in droves. So it's important to keep asking about that. and to reinforce the U equals U message. And we are still here to facilitate people's life goals, pregnancy, breastfeeding, trans health, and adolescent transition. So with that said, I'm going to move to the next part of the session.
Good afternoon. I'm Cristina Mustini from the University of Modena Reggio Emilia, and we are here to discuss real cases, which decision we should take in clinical practice. So this is the first case. His name is Marco. He's a 79-year-old Italian male presented for care with oral thrush and shortness of breath that started 2 weeks before. He did, obviously, in this period, a SARS-CoV-2 nasal swab that turned out negative. He was tested for HIV, and the result was positive. His blood gas was not good. Indeed, he had 54 of arterial oxygen. The bronchoalveolar lavage had the diagnosis for pneumocystis girovecii. So his clinician started him on cotrimoxazole and dexamethasone plus fluconazole for the oral thrush. So when would you start ART in this patient? Immediately, after 1 week, after 2 weeks, at the end of PCP treatment? I'm not sure. Just remember that he has a PCP and he has just been diagnosed. So Chloe and Jean-Michel, what do you think about this case?
Yeah, I mean, so I think there's a couple of interesting things that I would say even before answering the questions. And that is, it's great that the HIV thing happened, time of COVID, you know, and that he was tested. Because in our hospital, we put it as part of the protocol that every person with COVID was also tested for HIV. So that's a great thing, I think. And it's also interesting that he's 79. So he's in the age group where perhaps people are less likely to be tested. But in this situation, I would start treatment immediately because he doesn't have an opportunistic infection that would make us need to stop. So I would start immediate antiretrovirals.
Jean-Michel?
Yes, no, I agree with Chloe. I think it's fortunate that this gentleman was tested for HIV, because when you are 79 years old and you have a shortness of breath, PCP is not the first, diagnosis that you could make. And so I would say it's great that the diagnosis was made so quickly. And indeed, even though this gentleman would not have PCP, being HIV and at 79 years of age requires immediate treatment, because we know, according to sub-studies that were performed in the START study, for example, that, you know, a couple of features like older age, low CD4 cell count, high viral load, which is probably likely in this individual, require immediate treatment. So in addition, he has an OI. And clearly the interest of starting treatment right now is to avoid additional OIs or AIDS-related malignancy that may occur in these gentlemen. So clearly, especially since he is also on steroids, we do not fear IRIS in this case at this point. So there is clearly an emergency to start treatment.
I mean, I think the other point to make, before we actually look at guidelines, the other point to make is that we've got a good study to guide us here, and that's the ACTG 5164 study. And quite a lot of people in that study actually had PCP. A large proportion of the participants had PCP. And the study excluded people who were on ITU and who were requiring ventilation. So I think that he fits in very well with the population that was actually tested in the study, where early treatment was helpful. In fact, the earlier, the better. And I think that study, yeah, go on, Christina.
I was saying that immediate, for me in this case, and I just don't want to be provocative, but I think that in clinical practice, immediate, it's very complicated, because this is a patient who is starting on cotrimoxazole. We know that he could have some side effects for cotrimoxazole, like rash. So if you start immediately and he develops rash, it could be difficult to understand if it was the cotrimoxazole or the antiretrovirus. So in the ACTG, that is the next slide, actually, you can see that immediate was actually a median time of 12 days. So I don't want to say 12 days, but maybe just 1 week, I would wait in order to see if he can tolerate cotrimoxazole and fluconazole, and then start antiretroviral. What do you think?
Well, I think that's reasonable. And a lot of the immediate antiretroviral studies have, you know, amounted to a week. You know, like with the Diamond study, it was pretty much a week, you know, that was considered immediate. And I think immediate, you're right, is different in different hospitals and different levels of comfort. And what you're saying makes a lot of sense, you know, and the number of days you give it, whether you give it, you know, 2 days, 5 days, 7 days. I think the point is you do it as soon as you can do it in that person, you know, and I think the points that were made by Jean-Michel around IRIS are really important, you know, and I think you'd want to avoid illnesses where you have a high risk of IRIS. You know, you'd he was ineligible in that study. And obviously cryptococcal meningitis, you would certainly not want to do that.
Yeah.
One is absolutely. So I guess if we look at guidelines, it's interesting. The guidelines pretty much agree with us.
Yeah. But that's good because in most of the cases we wrote the guidelines.
Yeah. Very true. But I mean, it's interesting because I mean, they're saying what we're saying. They're saying start, I mean, the DHHS start immediately or as soon as possible. So it's, I mean, I think people recognize you want to get on with it. Everyone is agreeing on 2 weeks. You know, within two weeks, you want to wait beyond that. But, you know, as soon as you feel comfortable and you can see that Jean-Michel and I are more, let's get on with it immediately, and you are, let's wait a few days, but we all agree on the principle.
Yeah, unless the patient has one of these OIs like PML or cryptosporidium, where there is no treatment and antiretroviral therapy has shown to, you know, increase survival. But for the rest, I would wait a few days, but not, you know, because now with COVID, I think that rapid ART and even test and treat has become more and more common because you don't want the patient to come back more often to the clinic. So you, and also I really am a big supporter of test and treat because now we have this incredible counseling telling the patient that his life will be, you know, very similar to a person without HIV. He could have a normal sex life. He could have you know, you could have babies, you could deliver vaginally and whatever. And then you say, okay, let's wait, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks in order to have all the exam. So I prefer to start, you know, after diagnosis in order to, but this is not the case all the time, I mean, for OIs.
I think the other antiretroviral emergencies, I would say, are KS, Kaposi sarcoma, and HIVAM. You know, nephropathy, HIV-associated nephropathy. I think those are really emergencies. And I would argue that lymphoma is an emergency because you want the person undetectable before you start with the chemotherapy. You don't want to start chemotherapy at the same time as antiretrovirals. So I mean, those would be the emergencies. I mean, would you add any other specific, you know, very serious emergencies, Jean-Michel?
Well, I think you're right, and I agree with what you just said. Potentially, because this gentleman is 79 years old, I would be also concerned about, you know, AIDS dementia complex that may occur if we don't start ART early enough. So I would say for that reason, again, and you may have, you know, a neurocognitive impairment already in someone who is 79 and who has AIDS because he's been infected for a median of 11 years now. So that's another reason also to not defer ART for too long. And within 2 weeks, that's what the guidelines say. And so means that, you know, the earlier, the better, I would say, as soon as this person is able to swallow pills, especially since now with ART, you know, one or two pills per day is not a big deal in addition to the treatment for PCP.
Let's go to the question. Which regimen would you choose for this patient? So look at the regimen, the first line regimen in IAC guidelines, so dolutegravir, paclitaxel, TPC, you can read all of them. So please vote.
In my head, I wouldn't use a baclitaxel. You know, obviously, if you try starting immediate treatment, you can't use a baclitaxel, and also, you know, on the day treatment, and also with the heart potential an old person, cardiovascular risk, I wouldn't do that. In an older person, I would be sort of probably erring towards TAF rather than TDF. Given the renal issues. you know, and really DTG and, you know, bictegravir, I would see no difference. I'd start either B or C. I wouldn't start raltegravir because we wouldn't have a resistance test and it's got a low genetic barrier. So I'd go for one of the higher genetic barrier drugs. And Jean-Michel, what would you say?
Well, again, I think since we don't have an idea of his, renal function at this point, if we have to start immediately, clearly we cannot do a Bacavir, and TAF-FTC would be a good choice with DTG or Bictegravir. And, you know, we have to assess whether or not this is well tolerated. It's only if we have any, tolerability issue that we may think about using Raltegravir. An option that I would not use here would be the darunavir boosted PI because of the risk of, also hypersensitivity reaction, especially in someone already on cotrimoxazole. There is a risk of hypersensitivity cutaneous reaction with both the darunavir and cotrimoxazole because they are both related in terms of chemical structure. So clearly an integrase inhibitor here makes a lot of sense. And as far as we don't know about the renal function, TAF-FTC is the preferable option. I agree with Chloe.
Yeah, and one final point is that there's very low rates of integrase resistance circulating right now in the population.
Maybe the only point regarding the integrase inhibitors, the bictegravir and dolutegravir, is that we may see an increase in plasma creatinine that would be also seen with high doses of cotrimoxazole. So that's something we have to monitor. And that might be a reason for not, administering the two immediately together, just to see, what would be the creatinine plasma level with high dose cotrimoxazole in this person, and then add dolutegravir or bictegravir, a few days later to be able to manage this increase and understand what's going on.
Just one final point is on the two drug issue, because I guess we've got the Gemini study, dolutegravir 3TC is in guidelines. I would, although the data for viral load is good in terms of the Gemini study, we've got the low CD4 count issue, which wasn't virological, but it was related to other reasons in terms of worse performance in the low category. I personally feel there's no need to start a two-drug regimen in immediate treatment in someone like this. You may switch to that very quickly.
I completely agree.
I would not be doing that with this man. I really think there's enough going on and too many problems.
And in addition,
I completely agree.
Chloe said, we don't have the resistant genotype, so we don't know about 3TC resistance, and we don't know about HBV co-infection. So clearly, because we have to start very early in this person, we clearly are not in a position of using a dual combination.
And the second is Tara. She's a 30-year-old female from Ghana, so a completely different scenario. Arrived in Italy 5 years ago, started out with rilpivirine, FTC, tenofovir, diprioxid fumarate, virologic suppression maintained with CD4 count above 600, describes difficulty taking medication regularly because of the food requirement. At today's visit, the patient informs you that she's pregnant. So how would you approach managing her heart, continue the same regimen, or change to dolutegravir abacavir 3TC, change to dolutegravir tenofovir FTC or TAF, or tenofovir 3TC, change to raltegravir tenofovir FTC or tenofovir 3TC, change to darunavir tenofovir FTC or tenofovir 3TC, change to long-acting. We will be these drugs available very soon, or I'm sure.
Jean-Michel, would you want to come in?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Chloe. Well, I think first I would reassure this woman that, because she's fully suppressed on the ERT, there is no risk or a limited risk, of transmission of HIV to her baby. And that's something we need to reinforce, and that she would be able to have a normal delivery. You would not need a cesarean section if the viral load remains suppressed. So it's very important that she continues to take very well, as she did before, her pills to maintain this viral suppression. I think that's the most important point for this young woman at this point. And then in terms of regimen, I would say she's in an NTI-based regimen right now with drugs that we know have some, safety record. And therefore, I don't see any good reason at this point to change to a regimen with which she might have some tolerability issues. And at this point, I would maintain the treatment that she has.
I would say, because I agree with you, and rilpivirine is an option that she can take in pregnancy. You know, it's in the guidelines of pregnancy, and she's doing well. And I agree with your points. I mean, the only issue is that she, her adherence, she's finding it difficult to take the drug. And I guess I would worry a bit that with the volume of distribution changes in pregnancy, that although she says she's finding it difficult, she's doing very well, but I would worry a bit. So I would probably be inclined to switch her. And I think in terms of what I would switch her to, I would have no concerns about using dolutegravir. The initial signal around neurotubular defects in early pregnancy have been removed, and there is no statistically significant difference between people who don't receive antiretrovirals. So I would not worry about that. Rilpivirine is also a really good option in pregnancy, but I wouldn't use it 1200. I would use it as 4-4. But I think with rilpivirine, it's got a lower genetic barrier. So I might be inclined towards dolutegravir. Darunavir you can use, but you'd have to use it twice daily in later pregnancy. That's the guidelines. We may not do it, but that's the guidelines. I definitely wouldn't use cabotegravir or rilpivirine. There isn't enough data to support that. So I don't know. I totally hear Jean-Michel's point, but I might be inclined to switch.
Yeah, I think also that the patient is from Ghana. We have to understand how well she understands our language, and that our message is very good. And she's already complaining that she could not take regularly the medication. So it's something that I would take into account. So it's important to see that integrase inhibitor are the best guarantee to lead the woman to an undetectable viral load at the moment of delivery. And this is something, this is not the case of this woman because she didn't present late, but it's the case of many other who present late. And the fact that dolutegravir, for example, compared to efavirenz, was able to reach an undetectable viral load even in women who present very late in the third trimester. And if you can see from the next slide, this is completely independent from the baseline viral load or the baseline TD4. It's a sort of guarantee for us. And even if we are not in Africa, we are not in a situation where it's difficult for the patient to reach the hospital, but it's something that, as I said, reassuring.
Yeah, and I just, one thing I would pick up on is that we've seen these data from IMPACT 2010, and they really supported the use of TAF.
Yeah.
In pregnancy for the first time, you know, with better adverse event outcomes. And I think this has now gone into DHHS guidelines.
Yeah, I completely agree. And also the signal that there was with the weight gain, you know, we have to pay attention when the studies are conducted in different settings from ours, because, you know, there is the impact of return to health is different in Italy than in Africa, probably. So if we look at the recommended weight gain the second and third trimester, all the arms of the impact were below. So it's something that we have to keep in mind when we look at the data on weight gain, for example, in pregnant women. It is more difficult to evaluate, I think, than in the general population, because obviously you're pregnant.
Yeah, and I think, you know, failure to gain weight is not good for pregnancy outcomes. And we know that both efavirenz and TDF have led, but you can see very clearly in this cohort, inadequate weight gain. And you see that when you use dolutegravir, the women gain weight more similarly to women who don't have HIV, and you do need to gain appropriate weight. But then we've also seen that the metabolic problems for women who are already overweight, you know, then using integrase inhibitor there may not be sort of the best outcome.
Yeah, she's in rilpivirine, and this, you know, it's also in favor of what Jean-Michel was saying, because if we look at the register of the pregnancy, and this is the last report in January 2021, we could see that rilpivirine is really a regimen that didn't show any signal of possible birth defect. So it's the lowest one. So it's good also to maintain, but you have really to make a good deal with the patient that is taking the medication, because the obviously the genetic barrier of rilpivirine is not the best one. And, you know, it's important to make a deal with her.
No, I agree with you. I mean, we could propose a change in the treatment, but explaining that the reason for the change is because we are concerned about her adherence to treatment, not yeah. because of, you know, issues with the pregnancies or birth defects or anything else. And if we change the regimen, if she wants to change, because eventually the choice remains within her decision, you know, if she wants to change, we need to closely, in any case, closely monitor the viral load, because what's very important for, yeah. for her is to ensure that the baby will not be infected with HIV. And for that, we want to make sure that the viral load remains suppressed and to monitor closely the viral load, I would say. Because she said that she has issue with adherence, we may change treatment as you would recommend if she agrees to do that, because she might have used other treatment before. And the reason why she's on rilpivirine is because maybe she has tested other regimen and she was not very happy with them. In any case, we want to closely monitor the viral load, whether or not we do change the treatment.
I mean, I guess I just think Jean-Michel's point about, you know, putting the patient at the heart of the decision and bringing her along and letting her decide. We've seen with the dolutegravir debacle how crucial that is. And I think the mm-hmm. point you made, we can't state that more clearly.
Yeah. So the patient maintains virologic suppression after switching out. What would you recommend now? C-section, vaginal delivery, forceps delivery, unsure.
Well, I agree with Jean-Michel. It's vaginal delivery. If it, you know, as long as everything is fine, she's undetectable. It's normal pregnancy management.
Case three, the third case, is about Alessandro, 31-year-old man on stable ART with dolutegravir abacavir 3TC, initiated on January 2020, right before the pandemic. A virologic suppression maintained with CD4 cell count above 700 cells. Ongoing care provided virtually due to COVID-19. The patient has described bedridden, which were attributed to pandemic anxiety. At the last visit, the patient asked to change ART. How would you respond to the patient's request, given guidance on virtual HIV care during the pandemic? Change treatment only if he attends any in-person visit. Change treatment immediately. Ask him to describe his symptoms and quality of life using an online questionnaire. Unsure, please.
What do you think, Jean-Michel?
So I think we have really also to take in account what the patient says. So he says that he has bad dreams and wanted change to the treatment. We may not be sure that this is treatment related, of course. But, you know, one thing we want to avoid is that the patient, because he thinks that the treatment is responsible for his symptoms, would discontinue his treatment. And that would be a bad thing. So, again, we have to listen carefully to what he says. Try to explain that, you know, depending on how long he has been on dolutegravir, this is unlikely that this could be related to dolutegravir, although we know that they have some reports in a few individuals that would not tolerate dolutegravir well enough due to insomnia. But this is usually occurring during the first weeks of treatment, days or weeks. If that's the case, we may want to change treatment. So again, here, I would again reinforce the need for this person to continue his treatment. And if he really wants to change, then I would change treatment as soon as possible with a treatment that he has received in the past and with which he was comfortable.
Yeah, I totally mm-hmm. agree. I mean, I think we have to listen to the patient. He's described a known side effect of the drug. It's not like he's describing something that's never been described before. And he wants to change. I don't think you should only change people in person. I don't think that's realistic. We have to be more flexible. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no reason you can't have a treatment discussion on the phone. And I wouldn't put him through an online questionnaire. I'd talk to him and ask him what he thought, ask him about his mental health, exclude depression, and I would just change his treatment. What do you think?
Well, I agree. I think that if someone is complaining, it's something that, you know, we have to take into account, absolutely, and try to listen to him. So the decision is taken to change heart. Which regimen would you choose? Dolutegravir 3TC, Bictegravir TAF FTC, Darunavir, Tenofovir, FTC, rilpivirin TAF FTC, darunavir covicista TAF FTC, long acting, unsure, please. We have a, you know, we have plenty of choices because he had just one regimen and he could change it very easily and because he has no resistance. Sometimes when you have too many options, it even is even worse. So please.
I mean, I think, you know, I think there's some right answers. There's several right answers here, you know, depending on the discussion with him. I think bictegravir TAF FTC is a reasonable option. I think rilpivirine TAF FTC is a good option, certainly in terms of insomnia and side effects. It certainly was significantly better than efavirenz for this. I think offering a long-acting regimen is perfectly reasonable in this person. So I think there's lots of right answers. I mean, I think if there's no drug interactions, I don't think that darunavir cobicistat TAF FTC is a terrible option. We're not aware of any other medications. So I think there's lots of options. What do you think, Jean-Michel?
No, I agree. There are many options, you know, because this person complains of, you know, bad dreams, and that might be related to dolutegravir, then I would avoid dolutegravir and potentially also bictegravir as regimen, just to make sure that he doesn't need another change. The same is a bit true also with rilpivirine, because even though it was better tolerated than efavirenz, you know, there are a couple of people complain of, you know, CNS adverse events also with rilpivirine, although much lower than with efavirenz. So that's an option. But then I wonder whether the darunavir here, TAF FTC, cobicistat would not be a good option in case it doesn't have any co-medication that would be impacted by cobicistat. I would not use tenofovir unless we have a good assessment of his renal function, because if he's on abacavir, that might be a reason, and we just need to be careful about that if we are not able to test on the phone clearly his renal function. So we want to give him something that is safe.
We have some data switching from dolutegravir to bictegravir, and while from a virologic point of view it was very good, if we look at the side effects, when we look at insomnia, there is really not a big difference. The problem is that it's not a before and after study. So we don't know if those who experience insomnia with dolutegravir continue to have insomnia with bictegravir. So it's something that it's some datum that we really need. While with darunavir is the only one, darunavir cobicistat, 3TC, and TAF, is the only one that was, you know, that has been conducted a study that was presented at CROI this year. Is a Spanish study, the detox study, where they look at insomnia and depression in patients who are on dolutegravir, 3TC, abacavir, who switch to darunavir, cobicistat FTC, and TAF, and they show a better outcome. So it's in both of these, you know, they were very similar. But if you look and before at the column, before and after, and you see that with different questionnaires, they were better. So I just was wondering if, even if a boosted PI is not now a first choice, it would be on one hand important to have new data before and after, just to understand how the, you know, the symptoms are going, or if we could just choose a PI in this patient. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a good point. And I remember when I presented the AMBER study, one thing that I remember, and that's the naive study looking at DCF TAF, there were no CNS adverse events. And I think that as well, which is the switch study. So I think it was a perfectly reasonable option, you know, and I think that, you know, integrase inhibitors as a class can have insomnia as a side effect with rilpivirine, you know, with dolutegravir. You showed the data compared to bictegravir switch. You know, cabotegravir or pivirine, it wasn't a major problem, certainly not a lot of reports, certainly not above 10%, not even above 5%. But I mean, you could have, you know, I think it's an option. You could consider a long-acting option, but if you want to really avoid insomnia, you really, an evidence-based way of avoiding insomnia is definitely DCF TAF.
Now, I think there is a one comment I may want to add is that, you know, we are not sure that these insomnia is related to dolutegravir. So I think while we will accept to change the regimen and give him maybe the Ritonavir, Ritonavir or the Ritonavir Cobicistat and TAF-FTC, we probably have to tell him that it's not granted that this regimen change will improve his bad dreams or insomnia, and that, you know, we agree with him, you know, that there is a likelihood that, although low, that this would be related to dolutegravir. We may want to try to change the regimen, but if he sees no improvement, then we may come back to his previous regimen, which was better, was well tolerated as well.
No, I was just saying that if you look at the slide of the baseline characteristics of the detox, you could see here, you could see that the, you know, more than 50% of the patient had toxic habits. So maybe, you know, it could have been chemsex, for example, or other situation that, you know, other drugs that could have an impact on, you know, insomnia or on, you know, the lifestyle. And then there was the pandemic. So as Jean-Michel was saying, okay, you know, sometimes we rely on, you know, we give a too central role to antiretrovirals, but really in a big cake, it's just a small slice, the antiretroviral. So we could do this, but then we have to investigate all that. Yeah.
And if he's anxious about COVID, you know, he should receive vaccination against COVID if it's not, not already. And that might, you know, relieve his anxiety and he may have great dreams now.
Well said, Jean-Michel. Very well said. Yeah. And I think, you know, a psychology assessment is not a bad thing, you know, to look at other factors, you know, certainly questioning around habits. But I think, you know, there's also an element that, you know, everything adds up. You know, there's the pandemic anxiety, you know, potentially side effects of dolutegravir. You know, side effects can be reversed. And, you know, if there's anything you can do to help mental health, even 5% or 10%, you know, any improvement is always an improvement. So I think it's certainly part of it, but you're absolutely right. It's not everything. And we shouldn't forget someone can be depressed. Someone can be anxious, the whole person. But, you know, if you can take away something that's adding to someone's problems, you know, it's always great to be able to relieve something.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, you know, it's like weight gain. When the patient comes and, you know, she says or he says, you know, I cannot close my pants anymore, so it's the drug that you gave me. And then at the same time, she tells you that she went to menopause, she stopped quit smoking. You know that there are many other factors, but at that time you switch. I mean, I switch. So it's just, you know, you say, okay, let's try this. But obviously you go on a diet, try to exercise. But if the patient is convinced that it's the drug, it's difficult to maintain the drug, you know, unless it's the only possible treatment choice.
And I think Jean-Michel made this point earlier, and you're making it again. It's a really important point that we need to bear in mind that the single most important factor in adherence is toxicity. You know, it's been shown time and time again. It's not single tablet. If something causes side effects, that is what ultimately makes people want to stop it. So if someone is telling you, I think this drug is causing me insomnia, and you just ignore them because it's a phone appointment, you know, then, you know, a person could just take their own decision and stop taking treatment. So I think we have to listen, individualized therapy, as you're saying. Well, I think, you know, that was a great panel discussion and really interesting cases. And I think it's interesting to see how much the starting treatment is a complex and important area. And because we do it less now with opportunist infections, because we're diagnosing more, it's still a really complex and, you know, significant area to think about. And I think we clearly are we have much better options in pregnancy, you know, and I think that's great. We can now use TAF. We are not worried about dolutegravir. You know, we have lots of data on rilpivirine with very low birth side effects, you know, and we can see with someone who has CNS toxicity, we have other agents, we have other classes. Just because integrase inhibitors are recommended as first line doesn't mean they're the only class. We've got many choices, and we should remember the full spectrum of options that we have. So thanks for the discussion. It's been great.
So I've been asked to discuss the future of ART, and we have some time, and we could take questions at the end of this talk. So maybe I'll start with a global view of the antiretroviral coverage And according to UNAIDS, in 2020, there were 37.7 million of people living with HIV, 36 million of adults. And among those, 74% of adults, but only 54% of children are receiving ART. And so we are far from the 2030 target of 95% of people living with HIV on ART. So how could we do better to upscale ART coverage? At the same time, because DTG, TDF, and 3TC is now the first line treatment for patients living with HIV, the question is, how could we do better in terms of treatment since we have a great combination here? So I tried to summarize on this slide the attributes of the ideal ART regimen in the context where we don't have any HIV cure on the horizon. So I think first, effectiveness. And we need to have a very strong regimen with a very strong antiviral activity against all HIV-1 subtypes and also against HIV-2 because we have, much fewer options for treating HIV-2 infected individuals. Ideally, we would have a regimen with an activity against drug-resistant HIV and also HBV because, again, in many countries, co-infection with HBV is not something which is rare, in particular in sub-Saharan Africa or in Asia. Then we want to have a regimen with a good adherence. And for that, the regimen has to be simple, self-administered, with a high forgiveness. And that's why the advance of long-acting agents is potentially a great breakthrough in improving adherence to a daily pill. We also need, ideally, to have a regimen which adherence is easy to assess. We have, for example, the dry blood spot, which measures tadalafil diphosphate level in red blood cells and gives you an idea of the adherence over the prior 6 weeks. And that would be nice to have such tools for all drugs. Also, in case of virologic failure, we want to have a regimen with which the emergence of resistance is going to be low and especially cross-resistance to other drugs. Safety and tolerability for individuals is indeed a major concern. And we may have in the future a regimen with an almost perfect tolerability without any need to monitor safety. So there would be no weight gain, no renal issues, no bone issues. And this regimen has to be safe not only for adults, but also for children, pregnant women, adolescents, etc. We want to avoid or limit drug-drug interactions with rifampin, food effects, PPIs, for example. So again, we are mindful of drug-drug interactions when we prescribe ART. And finally, if we want to reach the 2030 UNAIDS target, we need to have a regimen that is easy to implement. So something that would be easy to store at room temperature, that would also be available at an affordable cost. So on this slide, you have a number of investigational ART drugs. One of them has been approved, and Chloe alluded to cabotegravir, rilpivirine, so I'm not going to touch on this combination, but other drugs are in development for being used in the future for long-acting ART, and I'm going to focus on, I would say, two of them mainly. The first is islatravir. Islatravir is formerly known as EFDA. This is an adenosine analog, which is a reverse transcriptase inhibitor, but also a translocation inhibitor. As you can see on this graph, a single dose of islatravir from 0.5 milligram to up to 30 milligram is associated with a very nice decrease in plasma HIV RNA. And this drug has also activity against NATI-resistant HIV strains. There was a good correlation between antiviral activity and the concentration of islatravir triphosphate in PBMC. So we have a target to reach to make sure that we have both this target. And what makes islatravir also quite interesting is its very long half-life intracellular in PBMCs. And so we reported previously in Glasgow the phase 2 results of the combination of islatravir and doravirine versus a standard of care of doravirine 3TC tenofovir in naive individuals who received initially during the first 24 weeks a triple regimen, and then those with the viral load undetectable switch to a dual combination of the doravirine and islatravir at different doses of islatravir from 0.25 to 2.25 milligram per day. And if we focus on the efficacy here, you can see that overall the response rate was high with combined islatravir arms in black as compared to red, the standard of care. And if we look in the red box as those with a viral load above 50, again, very few individuals had a viral load above 50 at week 96 or through week 96. And the proportion was similar with the islatravir, ravirine, and with the standard of care. Interestingly, in all individuals, when they had a viral load above 50, it remained below 80 copies, so no one was tested for resistance. And even in those who had a viral load above 50 with islatravir, ravirine, before the switch to a triple regimen, 5 out of 10 patients actually had a viral load before the switch being, again, below 50. In terms of tolerability, I would focus here on drug-related adverse events. And you could see at the last two columns that the rate of drug-related adverse events was lower with islatravir and ravirine in black as compared to the standard of care. And very few individuals discontinue the treatment because of drug-related adverse event. And with islatravir and ravirine, one patient discontinued because of gastrointestinal adverse event, and the other one because of HBV reactivation, because neither the ravirine nor islatravir have activity against HBV. I'll switch now to another NNRTI, MK-8507, which is actually similar structurally to the ravirine and therefore has a similar, as you can see here, resistance profile. So that's a drug that when given as a single dose is also associated with a strong decline in viral load after 7 days. And its PK, that's what makes it interesting, supports a once-weekly dosing. And there is an ongoing trial now comparing BICTAF-FTC to a weekly regimen of MK-8507 at 3 different doses, plus islatravir at 20 milligrams per week, to see whether we could indeed design a weekly oral regimen with 2 drugs in patients already fully suppressed. So we should get the first result within a couple of weeks now. Islatravir could also be given as a once monthly oral pill, and these are data from a PK study from a PrEP trial in which you could see that whether given at a dose of 60 milligrams per month or 120 milligrams per month, islatravir maintains islatravir triphosphate concentration in PBMCs above the threshold that is shown here with the red dotted line. So this drug, as you could see, could be given once a day, once a week, potentially also once a month, but then you have to find a partner to combine islatravir to another drug at least. That's where comes lenacapavir. Lenacapavir is also a very promising drug for you know, the future treatment and prevention of HIV infection. That's a first-in-class long-acting HIV capsid inhibitor, which can you know, prevent the capsid disassembly and therefore integration of the viral DNA in human genome, and also interacts with capsid assembly and virus production. It also has a low in vivo systemic clearance, a very potent antiviral activity, and slow release kinetics from subcutaneous injection. This drug can indeed be given either orally or as a subcutaneous injection. And when you look at the PK in the left-hand side when given subcutaneously, you can see that you reach in red at the dose of 900 milligram given at day zero, high concentration for the next 24 weeks. And that's why the drug is given or investigated now as a subcutaneous agent given every 24 weeks. At the same time, you see that during the first 4 weeks, you have an issue with drug concentration where are not high enough. And that's why on the right side, you know, the drug is also interesting to be given in combination orally during the first weeks, because when you give the drug orally, you have a very rapid plasma concentration that are above the threshold that is associated with antiviral activity. And that's why in clinical trials, for example, in the Capella study, where lenacapavir were tested in addition to a failing regimen in heavily treatment-experienced patients, it was given orally during the first 2 weeks, then subcutaneously every 24 weeks. And if we look at the first 2 weeks where the drug was given day one, day two, and day eight, you see a very nice decline in HIV viral load with lenacapavir. One of the issues with subcutaneous injections, which are given in the abdomen, is the injection site reaction. And although not everyone reported injection site reaction, which were most of the time mild injection site reaction, you could see that some patient experienced nodules that were long lasting, a couple of weeks or months in some individuals. So we probably need to know more of what would be the impact in these injection site reaction with lenacapavir in the future. In terms of genetic barrier to resistance, this was already seen in the CAPELLA study, but this was also evidenced in the CALIBRATE study, which results were reported earlier this year, where lenacapavir was given in addition to FTAF subcutaneously or orally versus standard of care of bictegravir FTAF. Although overall, you know, the viral suppression rate were very high in all regimen through week 28, we could see that in one participant, for example, there was emergence resistance with mutations that are associated with lenacapavir to increase in IC50 in vitro. So we have to bear that in mind for the future. What's interesting, because we have here two very promising agents, was that earlier this year we learned that Merck and Gilead made an agreement to develop these two drugs in combination. And the first outcome is this phase two trial, which is going to be launched very soon, assessing the combination of these two drugs as a weekly regimen. So we have now two weekly regimen that are being developed, both with islatravir and this one with islatravir and lenacapavir. So the drug are given on day one and two, and then day eight, and every 8 days versus a daily regimen. And I think this is interesting for patients to take drugs only once a week, and let's hope that these results of this study will be very good. I'd like to finish with neutralizing antibodies, which are also developed for treatment and prevention of HIV infection, and which have a long acting activity. Many monoclonal antibodies are being developed. VRC01 is one of them. They are targeting some part of the HIV envelope. And it was reported earlier that when these monoclonal antibodies were given in individuals with fully suppressed HIV viral load, you could defer for a few weeks the viral rebound. But this was not as good as expected. And in addition, you know, the administration of these monoclonal antibodies here, it was VRC01, was associated with selecting pressure on the viruses with increased resistance to the antibody in the future. It is interesting to note that the field now is moving to combination of neutralizing antibodies, but also to combination of neutralizing antibodies with lenacapavir, for example, and know that Gilead has acquired two of these monoclonal antibodies from NIH. There is a study that will address this combination of drugs and monoclonal antibodies. Finally, islatravir and other drugs like TAF or cabotegravir are being also developed as implants. And I think this is also a very nice way of using these drugs, mostly for prevention, but potentially also for treatment if you could combine multiple drugs in the same implants. And these are PK data showing that with an islatravir implant inserted at day zero, you have and you maintain very high concentration of islatravir triphosphate in PBMC for at least 12 weeks. And in a model, these concentration would remain high enough for at least a year. And the first trials in patients with islatravir implants will start very soon. And last, these alternative mode of administration, microneedle array patches. There was a presentation at CROI with bictegravir. And this is also interesting to think that this drug could be delivered through the skin with these microneedle patches, which will be able to deliver the drug for a couple of months following the administration of the patch. So there's more to come in this area of developing long-acting drugs. So in summary, I would say that the ideal antiretroviral combination is not yet available, that long-acting agents could be game changer, and I've listed a number of drugs that could be used either weekly, monthly, or maybe yearly. What about neutralizing antibodies? We don't know yet. And that's why actually WHO is convening a conference on antiretroviral drug optimizations, which was held a few days ago. And I think the report from this conference is going to be important to know what the future may look like. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much for listening. To learn more from this program, see the links in the show notes. Thank you, and we'll see you on the next CCO podcast soon.